We are continuing our study in the book of Ecclesiastes. And last time we were in chapter 9. And we read about halfway through chapter 9, but it's a short chapter, and I want to keep it in context. So we're going to go ahead and read the whole chapter here and then talk about it all in context, and you'll see what I mean. For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hands of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath is he who fears an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun. One thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, and the memory of them is forgotten. Also, their love, their hatred, and their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. Go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Okay, so one of the things that this chapter is really focusing on and really kind of summarizing is this same thing that Solomon said throughout Ecclesiastes, is that whatever you do in life, your life comes to an end. And when it comes to an end, all that stuff you did is gone. And he kind of reinforces that and repeats a lot of this. And he says, to the good and the clean and the unclean, to he who sacrifices, he who obeys the law and things like that, and he who doesn't, the good, the sinner, he who takes oaths, you know, and he who's afraid to take an oath, you know, all those things. He said the same thing happens to them all. They all die. Now, Solomon is not saying that there's not a difference in the eyes of God between the righteous and the wicked, or the good and the sinner. What he's saying is no matter what, they all die. That is the lot of man. And you'll see that a lot of what Solomon has talked about so far and what you're going to see for the rest of this, especially at the end of the book, is he's talking about the situation that all men find themselves in. We're all in this life. We all have needs and wants. We all have fears and sorrows. We all have good times and bad times, and we all die. And he's telling us that for what those things are, you know, we have the blessing of life that God has given us. We have the, you know, like he says in verse 7, eat your bread, drink your wine with a merry heart, you know, enjoy your life, enjoy the fruit of your labor. And don't, you know, don't be a workaholic that never enjoys the fruit of his labor and all those things we've said. But he says that is the focus. His focus here is on the living. And you can really see that in verse 5. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward. The memory of them is forgotten. Also, their love, hatred, and envy have now perished. And they will never have a share in anything done under the sun. That is a key phrase. When Solomon's talking about under the sun, he's talking about in our physical life. He's not saying that you die and you're gone. You know, like they used to say, when you're dead like Rover, you're dead all over. In other words, there's no soul, there's no eternity, there's no afterlife. He's not saying that. And the Bible, from Old Testament to New Testament, even Solomon himself says it in Ecclesiastes. Remember he set eternity in the hearts of men? So he's not talking about eternal life here. He's talking about physical earthly life. And he's saying when you die, that's it. There's no more reward. There's no more reward in this life. There's nothing you can't take it with you. It's all gone. And your love and your hatred and your envy are perished. All those emotions that wrap you up in your life are all gone when you're in the grave. Now, another thing he says here in verse 3, There is an evil in all that is done under the sun. The one thing happens to all. He's talking about death. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. That's a pretty depressing view of mankind. But you know what? It's a scriptural view. The hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. What does it say in Romans? Paul said in Romans, all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Right? What did Solomon just say a few chapters ago? I've looked for righteous people. I've maybe found one man in 1,000, and I still haven't found a woman, you know? And then what does he say? Men, God made men righteous, but they have sought after many schemes. This is all the fruit of our labor, in that we seek wickedness and we seek sin. You know, there's that verse in the New Testament that says, the men love darkness rather than light. That's really the same thing Solomon's saying here. Given a choice, and God gives us all choices, given a choice, we choose to rebel against God. You know, and he says, that's the state. Everybody's in that state. How are we going to get out of that? You know, and he's going to tell us at the end of the book that, you know, we need to fear God and keep his commandments. But what he's saying here is, you know, this is really a pretty, futile kinds of situation. And futile should ring a bell, because how many times has he said, this is vanity, this is a chasing after the wind, this is a great evil? You know, meaningless, meaningless, you know, some translations put it. He's saying, this is all futile. Your life on earth and all the money you earn and all the pleasure you can get and everything else, that is not going to do you any good where you were going. The one thing that is going to do you good is fearing God and keeping his commandments. And that's what he says at the end of the book, to kind of spoil the punchline at the end. But it's good to repeat it, because it won't spoil. That's the beauty of it. Okay, and then he says, but to him, in verse 4, he said, but to him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. Now, to understand the meaning of this, you got to know a little bit about Palestinian culture. Dog in Palestinian culture was pretty much the lowest of the animals. You know, and if you've ever been around in the third world countries where they don't have animal control officers, you got wild dogs or dogs basically running wild in the streets, breeding all the time. There's all kinds of dogs around, and they're usually hungry, scrawny, and diseased. It's pretty awful in most of the countries that I've been in. Stephen's probably had similar experience in Africa. But he says a living dog is better than a dead lion. Now, a lion for a Jew was like, hey, the lion of the tribe of Judah, right? That's how Jesus is described. You know, the lion was the king of beasts. And he says, you know what? A living dog is better off than a dead lion, because he's alive. He's still alive. He still has an opportunity. Mm. He says in verse 5, for the living know that they will die. See, that's one of the advantages of the living. But the dead, they're dead, right? The living still have an opportunity to live and to decide how they're going to do and how they're going to live and how they're going to serve God. And then when you're dead, it's over. So, you know, whatever you did in your life, that's what you're stuck with. You can't do anything after that. So we'll go ahead and continue. Verse 7. So he just in the first half of Ecclesiastes 9, he basically says everybody's going to die. Good and bad, good and evil, doesn't matter. We're all going to die. So in verse 7, he says, so eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments be white, and let your head lack no oil, and live joyfully with the wife whom you love. I'll stop there. We'll continue it. But you get the theme here. He says, if you've been blessed in this life, enjoy it. God has given you those blessings. He's accepted the fruit that you have. He's accepted what you've done, where he says he's already accepted your works. He says, or you wouldn't have these fruits to enjoy. So enjoy them. You know, it says, let your garments be white and let your head lack no oil. That, you need a little bit of cultural context. White garments, you know, required work, right? I mean, we all know this, right? Because I just installed a washing machine in my house today. If we don't clean the garments, they get dirty. So, you know, to have white garments here in the Old Testament meant that you were really blessed to be able to have clean clothes all the time. And then he says, let your head lack no oil. He's talking in a couple of senses. One of the things that they used oil for in the Palestinian area, in Palestine, and in the ancient Israel area, was to basically oil their hair. And to put oil on their head, kept their scalp from drying out. And also as a hairdresser, just to look good, you know, good grooming. I mean, all these things are kind of put together. You'll also see, of course, they use anointing oil when they anointed the priests or they anointed a king. They'd pour oil on their head, and it would run down their hair and into their beard and down on their clothes. And that was a blessing. That was seen as a blessing. So here he's saying, you know, you've been blessed. Enjoy your blessings. And verse 9 is you know, really one of my favorites in this whole section. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Now he says, right, your vain life and all those vain days that you're working. He says, you know, at the end, when you die, they're done. But to have a wife and to have a wife that you love and who loves you, and you can live joyfully with that wife all the days of your vain life, that is such a great blessing. It says that is your portion. That is a blessing. That is a big slice of happy life pie that God has put on your plate. And if you're blessed with a wife or a husband who love you, then live joyfully with them. You know, there's that same theme that we see with Solomon saying, enjoy the life that God has blessed you with. It is a blessing from God, so enjoy it. It doesn't mean just indulge in pleasure all the time and forget about, you know, righteousness and things like that and serving God. But he says, look, God's given you these blessings. He gave them to you to enjoy, so you should enjoy them. I love that one verse that says, if a man finds a wife, he finds a good thing. And, yes. You know, it's really true. It's really true. Of course, Solomon, the very same writer, and Stephen, you probably have hit on a couple of these when you're reading through Solomon. You know, Solomon says there's not much worse than a wife who's like a dripping faucet, basically. It's better to live on a corner of a house on the roof than to live with a contentious woman. You know, so there he recognizes that not every marriage is happy, and that's not just on the woman's side. There's plenty of good women that are married to bad men, too. But here he says that a good marriage is a great blessing from God. And then he says in verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. This has two parts. For one, he's still talking about that when you're dead, and there's nothing more you can do about it. Your life is over at that point. You wait for your judgment. But notice what he says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. This sounds almost exactly what Nathan, prophet, told David, who was Solomon's father, right? This is 40 years or so before, when David says, I think I want to build a temple for God. And Nathan said, do whatever your hand finds to do. Do it with all your might. God is with you, right? There's encouragement from God, and in this verse as well, for, you know, he created us to do works. We are created in Christ for good works, the New Testament says. He created Adam to tend the garden, Adam and Eve to care for the Garden of Eden. You know, we were created for work. And so, find work to do. Go after it. And notice it doesn't say you have to be a farmer or you have to be a baker or you have to be a soldier or whatever it is. He says, whatever your hands find to do, we have the liberty as God's creation to decide what career we want to take up and what work we want to do, but do it with all your might. Solomon says an awful lot about being slothful, and he's going to say a lot in the next chapter about that. Says a lot about it in Proverbs. You know, the lazy man and the fool, you know, they all have their reward, and it's not a good one. But here he talks about diligence. He says, find your work and do it with all your might. Okay. So let's go ahead and move on into chapter 10 here. Chapter 10 really starts a couple of chapters, which is more or less collections of general wisdom. They're very similar to the Proverbs, which are collections of general wisdom of Solomon. But you're going to see some of the things that he talks about, that he's talked about before, kind of echoed in these. One of the things I wonder about, you know, is Solomon just you almost think that if you followed Solomon around in the castle, right, it's like every now and then he'd just say, a wise man's heart is in his right hand, but a fool's heart is in his left. You know, this guy was so wise that it was just kind of dripping off of him all the time. And that you know, especially from the Proverbs, like Proverbs chapter 2 and others, where he's teaching his children wisdom or trying to teach his children wisdom, that he was constantly teaching and sharing this wisdom. If we remember what the name of the book of Ecclesiastes means, Ecclesiastes means the preacher. So Solomon was teaching. This is the reason he is putting this information out. He is trying to teach people. He is trying to help them be wise. And so in all these things, even though you run into a section where there's just, you know, a collection of Proverbs, a couple of verses long each, that have a little bit of wisdom or, you know, in them, a lot of wisdom in them, but just a little short piece, and it's not a continual thought, that's just Solomon sharing wisdom. All the things that he's learned. Remember when he started the book of Ecclesiastes, he said, I set my heart to know wisdom and to know folly and madness, and I worked really, really hard at it my whole life, and here's what I've learned. So this is stuff we need to pay attention to. Some of it you might not find an application in your own life, but most of it you do. So that's our challenge as we go into these next couple chapters, is when we're reading about this kind of general wisdom that Solomon's conveying here, how does it apply to us? So let's go ahead and read, we'll read the first 10 verses of chapter 10. Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. Even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks wisdom, and he shows everyone that he is a fool. If the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post, for conciliation pacifies great offenses. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, as an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, while the rich sit in a lowly place. I have seen servants on horses, while princes walk on the ground like servants. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them. And he who splits wood may be endangered by it. If the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. But wisdom brings success. Now, there's another 10 verses here, but let's just kind of stop for these and go into them a little bit. The first three verses are really talking about foolishness, some attributes of the fool. As dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor, so does a little folly to one respected of wisdom and honor. Wisdom and honor. So what he's talking about here with the perfumer's ointment, you know, today, if you look at a lot of the things like the lotions and perfumes that we use, lots and lots of them have preservatives in them. We used to not do that. If you made a lotion or some sort of an oil or a cream or a perfume, you were usually using animal products, like animal fat, for instance, would have been a prime example of that. And what happens to that if you just let bugs get into it? It starts stinking, right? Because it gets infected with bacteria, and the bacteria eat some of it and puts off a foul odor. And that's what he's talking about here in the physical sense. But notice what he says. How's he drawing the comparison? Just like dead flies spoil the perfume, so does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. Someone who's normally respected for wisdom and honor and goes off in a little folly, it caused him to stink. You know, and I think Solomon, you know, again, Solomon is writing this at the end of his life. He's already done a lot of stuff in his life, including some things that were not wise, like marrying 700 women and having 300 concubines, and several who were not Israelites and who were idolaters, who led his heart away from God. We know that from the scripture. So he says, you know, he could just as easily say this about himself. I'm respected for wisdom and honor, but you know what? I've had some folly in my life, and it's given off a foul odor in my life. He could say that about himself. I'm putting words in his mouth, but I think it applies. Verse 2, a wise man's heart is in his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Well, now, hold it. Why would it matter which hand your heart's in? Okay, think about it in a culture who uses, you know, uses tools and weapons. Basically, right-handedness is way more common than left-handedness. And if you're a right-handed person, you want your tool, whether it be a shovel or an axe or a sword, in your strong, dominant hand. So when it says a wise man's heart is in his right hand, it's right with where he can use it and control it. The fool's heart is not in his right hand, it's his left. In other words, he's not paying attention. And he's not going to be able to use it properly. Verse 3. Even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks wisdom and shows everyone that he is a fool. Solomon has no time for fools. You see this all through the Proverbs. He says the fool can't even disguise the fact that he's a fool. It's obvious to everyone he's a fool. Even when he's walking down the street, it's obvious that he's a fool. If a spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post. For conciliation pacifies great offenses. Here he's talking about a situation that, in fact, the next several verses here to verse 7, he's talking about situations with rulers. And really, in this case, it's a bad ruler. Because he's talking to this person that he's trying to teach and be wise. And he says, if the spirit of the ruler rises against you, if you've done something to offend the ruler or the king, and that might even be doing something righteous, right? Don't leave your post. You know, this is if you've been assigned a job by the king and the king gets mad at you, don't run away. You know, calmness, conciliation. Calmness pacifies great offenses. But face up to him and say, no, this is what I'm doing. You know, I'm not going to run away. I'm not going to rail against you or something. He says more about that later. It says it pacifies great offenses. 5-7 talks about a bad ruler and what a bad ruler has done. He says, there is an evil I have seen under the sun as an error proceeding from the ruler. So here he is. Here's the error proceeding from some ruler that Solomon knew. Folly is set in great dignity while the rich sit in a lowly place. And I've seen servants on horses while princes walk on the ground like servants. He's saying that there's a ruler somewhere, whether he's a king or a governor or whatever, who is dignifying the foolish, while the wealthy in his kingdom are made to sit on the ground like fools. And the servants are put on the horses while his princes, who should be his nobles, should be the people he's going to trust to help him rule his country, are dishonored like they're just common servants. So he's saying here's a situation of poor judgment by a ruler. He says it's a bad thing that happens. The next two verses, he talks about the risks of life. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. You know, in all of these things, he's saying you need to take care in life. Do what you find. Do it with all your might, but be smart, be wise, and take care. Be careful. You know, if you go quarry stones all day, if you're cutting stones out of the side of a mountain, guess what those stones are going to do occasionally? They're going to fall. And if you're under them, you're going to be hurt or killed. He who splits wood may be endangered by it. Anybody who's ever worked with an axe all day long will know exactly what he's talking about here. In fact, the next verse, verse 10, is an example of that. If the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. But wisdom brings success. If you're wise, you know, Abraham Lincoln is credited with saying this, if I had 8 hours to chop down a big tree, I'd spend the first 6 hours sharpening the axe. That's some of the same wisdom that Solomon's talking about. You know what the most dangerous knife is? A dull one. You know, if you have a dull kitchen knife, you are more likely to get hurt with a dull kitchen knife than you are with a razor sharp one. And the reason is you don't respect it because you know it's dull and you end up getting hurt. And two, you're having to put way more force on it to get the same job done. You're using brute force, which is kind of an example of foolishness, instead of wisdom and skill and care. And that's what he's saying here in verse 10, using that as an example. He's saying, yep, you got to go out in life and you got to be careful out there. It's dangerous out there. Use your wisdom. You know, don't go out and just brute force, bang around and try to force things through. You're going to get hurt. All right. We're going to continue with chapter 10, verse 11. I'll read the rest of the chapter here and we'll use it for context. We might actually get through chapter 10 tonight. The serpent may bite when it is not charmed. The babbler is no different. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his talk is raving madness. A fool also multiplies words. No man knows what is to be. Who can tell what will be after it? The labor of fools wearies them. They do not even know how to go to the cities. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, and your princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles, and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. Do not curse the king, even in your thought. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. So you can see, this is kind of a collection, kind of a potpourri, a mixed bag of wisdom. In verse 11, a serpent may bite when it is not charmed. He's not talking about some sort of magic. He's talking about somebody who knows how to handle a snake. If you don't know how to handle a snake, guess what? You're going to get bit. I grew up in South Texas. There's snakes everywhere. You know, the first rule in Texas is you find a snake, you kill it. Then you worry what species it is because they're almost all poisonous. But notice the analogy he's making here. The serpent may bite when it is not charmed, and the babbler, which is the fool, is no different. He's saying if you let someone just rattle their mouth off, guess what? They're going to bite. They're going to bite you. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of the fool swallow him up. You get a feeling in here that maybe the tongue is a real challenge for people, even in Solomon's day. Yep, same thing. Same thing you read in the book of James, right? He says the tongue is an unruly evil and no man can tame it. And it's the same thing here. Solomon's talking about the fool cannot control his tongue, and it's going to swallow him up. The words begin in foolishness, and they end in raving madness. He multiplies words. You know, there's another verse earlier in Ecclesiastes that says, the wise man uses few words, and the fool gushes folly. Nobody knows what is to be. And who can tell him what will be after him? This is Solomon reflecting exactly what he said before. We don't know our future on this life, for sure. We know we're going to die. But we don't know what's going to happen to us tomorrow. The labor of fools weary them. They do not even know how to go to the city. Their work, wears them out because they're so foolish. The next couple of verses talk about a situation, two different situations, and contrast it, where a man is ruled by a king who's just a child and doesn't have any wisdom versus a king who is a son of nobles and is trained in wisdom. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is a son of nobles and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. If your princes, who should be helping you rule the country, if they're sitting around eating and drinking and getting drunk and everything all day long, they're focused on pleasure. They're not focused on righteousness. And he says, if your king is a child, if he's not strong enough and wise enough to rule, then people are just going to do whatever pleases them, and they're not going to be a successful country. They're going to be an unruly land. But if your king is the son of nobles and has been trained and is wise, then your princes are going to feast at the proper time for strength, given the strength they need to help run the country well. Verse 18, because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. Boy, that's a general proverb for sure. But he's also talking here about the king who doesn't take care of business. Right? What's going to happen to your country if you don't take care of it? You know, we've seen some of that in our own country. You know, you look at what happens. What's about our roads and our bridges? You know, back in the 50s, after World War II, the 50s and 60s, America spent a huge amount of money building the national highway system. You know, back in the 30s before World War II and the Depression, they created programs that built all the roads and the bridges almost in the United States and built a lot of the schools. All those now are decaying because they haven't been kept up. He says, through laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. The lazy man won't even patch the roof. He just kind of moves over to the other part of the house and hopes it's going to stay dry for a few more days. You know, that's laziness. That's what Solomon preaches against all the time. Verse 19. A feast is made for laughter and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. This is a little bit sarcastic in the sense that obviously he says, sure, if you're having a feast, enjoy it. And wine makes merry. And says, but money answers everything. It's like, if that's all that your life is eating and drinking and making money, this is not what the wise man does. Sure, enjoy the fruit of your labor. Absolutely. And he says, money is a good thing. If you use it wisely, it's a way to protect you from a lot of trouble. But someone who just lives for it and that's all they do is not going to succeed. Verse 20, you may have heard parts of this somewhere else. Do not curse the king, even in your thought. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. Have you ever heard the saying, be careful, a little bird might tell them? This is the verse where that came from. A little bird told me. This is exactly the verse where that idea came from. But notice the big principle here. Do not curse the king, even in your thoughts, and do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. Wow. How many times do people do that? Whoever the ruler is, and it doesn't matter whether you agree with them or not. It doesn't matter if they have good laws or bad laws. It doesn't matter. They are the ruler. You know, Daniel said this to Nebuchadnezzar. When Nebuchadnezzar had that dream, remember, and Daniel said, you know, God had given him the interpretation of the dream. But the first thing Daniel says is, I didn't do this. God gave it to me. And let me tell you about my God. He sets up kings and he takes down kings. He is in control. And that's what you're hearing here. If there's a king, he is there because God has put him there, period. What if he's a wicked king? God has put him there, period. You know that because every situation we see about that in the Bible, where there's a wicked king, there's very often a prophet there that says, God put you there for a reason. You see that later. You see Paul saying the same thing. He says, we've got to honor the king. We've got to pray for the king. And oh yeah, it happens to be Nero Caesar, who's lighting up Christians in his garden for fun. You know, God is serious about the rulers that he puts over men. And even if you don't like them and you don't agree with them, and even if they're wicked, you are not to curse them, not even in your thoughts. Don't curse the rich, even in your bedroom. Is there really ever a reason for a Christian to curse anybody? Really? Think about it.
No.
You know, we're not to do that.
No.
God is the one. You know, there is a great verse that says, do not avenge yourself. Leave it to God. God will repay. He says, vengeance is mine. I will repay. You don't have to curse that person. God's going to take care of him. And that's the end of chapter 10. We'll go ahead and stop there for tonight. There's lots more good stuff in the next couple chapters. We've only got two more chapters of Ecclesiastes. Thank you for being with us tonight. And may God bless you as you consider this wisdom. Stephen?